The following sermon was recorded at Pipe Creek Community Church in Pipe Creek, Texas. For more information, visit our website at pipecreekcc.com. May God bless you as you study His Word.
So this morning we continue in Daniel chapter 7, part 2. It was my intention when we began Daniel, as I began to plan and outline it, to kind of take a 30,000 feet perspective of Daniel, kind of a one sermon per chapter, big picture presentation of Daniel. And we stuck to that pretty well, I guess. And when we got to this, to the prophetic parts, to the apocalyptic visions that are part of the second half of the book, to try to avoid staying out of the weeds of identifying every little symbol, trying to match it up with some historical figure, like the Pope, or the United Nations, or something like that. When you get in the weeds too much, you miss the big picture. When you miss the big picture, I think, in Daniel, you miss the point, perhaps. But as the Lord has willed it, He's given us a part two this week. And He's allowed us to stretch our legs a little bit. So we're going to dig in a little bit deeper into Daniel chapter 7. And reemphasize, of course, the big picture of Daniel, but also get an even better understanding of what these beastly kingdoms are. And how it relates to the rest of the book itself. So speaking of big picture, Daniel chapter 7 gives us a sweeping vista of redemptive history. We are given a far-reaching view from the Babylonian exile and Nebuchadnezzar's rule in Babylon to the cross of Christ and His triumph for our redemption there, all the way to Christ consummating that redemptive victory and returning, redeeming all things back to Himself, making everything bad and sad untrue, and everything new. That's the scope we're talking about. We start with beasts that are the Babylonian kingdom, when Nebuchadnezzar's king. And we get to the end of all things when the books are opened. And at the same time, we get the triumph of the Son of Man in His ascension. That's the scope of Daniel chapter 7. As you move into Daniel chapter 8 and 9, you get pieces and parts of this larger scope. But in Daniel chapter 7, you get big picture. So that's kind of how we're supposed to interpret it. I think that's the interpretive key for us as we look at Daniel chapter 7. We are covering quite a bit of time, obviously. And you really see this in verse 16, and 17, and 18. Daniel approaches one of those who's standing there, worshiping the Ancient of Days, looking at the Son of Man and His ascension. He tells me the interpretation of these things, he says. And then verse 17, this is the scope. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. Now remember, the four great beasts, if we start with Babylon, which we're fixing to talk about, we're in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. So Babylon is still reigning at this time, at the time of this vision. But we're looking even back a little bit to Nebuchadnezzar's reign, because I think we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar in this dream. And we're going all the way through history with these four beasts, or these four successive kingdoms. And then in verse 18, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. So, see, we're going from verse 17, the beasts of history, to verse 18, forever and ever and ever. That's the scope. That's what we're talking about. You can see this. Go back to the beginning of chapter 7, and it's verse 3, and it's the beasts. And then you go to the end of Daniel in verse 27. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the saints. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom. History, verse 3. Eternity, verse 27. So there you go. I think that's how we're supposed to understand Daniel. Chapter 7, we talked about last week, is a bridge connecting chapters 1 through 6 with chapters 7 through 12. But I also want to show you the interconnectedness of these, the two halves of this book. Because there's an interconnectedness and there's a unity that exists in all of Daniel. But you can see from the verses I just showed you, going back into history, the earthly kingdoms of history, all the way into eternity till the end of all things and Christ's return, that the beginning is anticipating the end, and that's the way it is with Daniel. The first six chapters are anticipating the last six chapters. So there is a unity. And there's a clarity, I think, in the most important themes. So I want you to see that. Recognize, in chapters 1 through 6, this is what we've seen. We've seen Nebuchadnezzar attacking God's people. Chapter 1, plundering the temple of God in Jerusalem. That's in chapter 1. And then in chapter 5, we have Belshazzar, who uses the implements of the temple of God to praise his false pagan gods. And the first six chapters, we've seen proud kings like Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 be humbled. And Belshazzar in chapter 5, humbled to his destruction. And in the midst of the plundering and the persecution of God's people, in the midst of praising false gods and blaspheming the true God, we've seen, in the midst of this, we've seen God's people. We've seen God's people tempted to compromise, threatened with death, yet faithful. Young men come out of the fiery furnace. Daniel comes out of the lion's den, delivered from death, faithful through judgment, like a resurrection from the dead. They don't even have the smell of smoke on them. Not just surviving, new. Out of the lion's den, not even a scratch. And through it all, in these first six chapters, God bringing an end to kingdoms. Nebuchadnezzar, then it's Belshazzar, and that's over with his destruction. Next, and it's Darius and Cyrus, and it's going to continue like that. But that's what we've seen in the first six chapters. And as we move into chapter 7 through 12, listen, you're going to see the same thing. It's a different kind of literature. Yes, it's got symbols and pictures, startling figures. Yet you're going to see the same thing. You're going to see wicked kings attacking God's people, like you're seeing in chapter 7. You're going to see it in chapter 8. You're going to see it in chapter 9. You're going to see it in chapter 11. You're going to see these wicked kings not only attacking God's people, but making an effort to stamp out the worship of God. All the while exalting themselves in the place of God. What you saw in chapters 1 through 6, with Nebuchadnezzar making himself God, and Belshazzar making himself God, and blaspheming God, and refusing to acknowledge God while attacking God's people and persecuting them. All those things you're going to see in chapter 7 through 12. Do you see the same themes? You're also, in chapter 7 through 12, going to see God's people persecuted. What are you seeing in chapter 7? And this little horn comes up and wears the saints out and prevails over them out of this beastly fourth kingdom. But this fourth beast is destroyed, thrown in the fire, and the saints will possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. It's not lion's den and fiery furnace, but it's the people of God prevailing. Once again, through difficulty, through threat. People of God faithful. You're going to see that in chapter 7 through 12. We've seen it already in this chapter. You're going to see the deliverance of God. Just as He delivered Daniel, just as He delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Preserving them, sanctifying them. Faithful to His people in exile. Gonna get them home. And here, in chapter 7 through 12, you see the same thing. God faithful to His people in exile. Promising to return them home. Ultimately, the ultimate exile at the end of chapter 12 will be accomplished when you and I are resurrected from the dead and are with our Lord forever and ever and ever. These same themes throughout. And these themes in chapters 1 through 6 and these themes in chapters 7 through 12 are filled. Chapter 7 is filled with these themes. It's the bridge that's connecting them. Chapter 7 is like a little book of Daniel in and of itself. What do you see in chapter 7? Proud, wicked kings humbled. God's people prevailing, faithful to the end. A God who is faithful, strengthening them, keeping them, preserving them. A God who is sovereign over all these beastly kingdoms. And the glorious Son of Man inaugurating this superior kingdom. The one to whom Daniel pointed in Daniel chapter 6 in the lion's den. Is the Son of Man now ascending to the right hand of the Father. So, what do we have here? This big picture perspective of Daniel. What are we supposed to get out of it? I'm going to give it to you. If we get nothing else this morning, if I start talking about horns and wings on lions and stuff, and you lose your brains, please remember these things. God is not giving us a code to figure out so we can know the future. That's not what this is about. This isn't a puzzle we're supposed to work. We're supposed to figure out, like Sherlock Holmes. This is a presentation of God showing us that He is sovereign over the unfolding of history. He is sovereign over the present powers of this world and the situations and circumstances that you are in. And the future is secure in His hands. We win because He wins. That's what you're supposed to see. This vision is given to a suffering people, to a people in exile. Has God given up on us? Is God still on the throne? How is all this going to work? Recognize that when chapter 7 ends, Daniel does not want to have a party. You and I see the Son of Man rising to the right hand and we think, yes, sir. He doesn't understand. Chapter 7 ends with Daniel troubled. He doesn't hooray. He doesn't want to have a party. He doesn't celebrate. He's struggling. Even after seeing the Ancient of Days in all His glory, seeing this Son of Man trying to come to grips with all that means. For Daniel, what Daniel needed to know is that God is sovereign over all these things and His future is secure. Why is he troubled? Because he has figured out, he has just been told that in this great victory that God has given, that God will give to His people, there is still suffering coming. He will give His people a kingdom forever and ever and ever. And then, give me a better explanation of this fourth beast, please. And he finds out that the fourth beast and the little horn will prevail over them and wear the saints out. How does this work? So Daniel is trying to come to grips with these things, these big themes, and they're clear. And I want us to make sure that we have them clear in our hearts and minds as well. Now we also understand what this Christian life is going to be like. As the beastly kingdoms confront us. So let's work through this. 3 points this morning. We're going to see God reigns over history. The Son of Man rises in victory. And the Lord rules with authority. Okay. First, God reigns over history. Last week we mentioned verse 9 and 10. Daniel receives this vision of the Ancient of Days. This vision of God. God in His heavenly court. God putting His power and purity and providence on display in His ruling over the kingdoms of this world. And He's sitting in judgment over these beastly kingdoms. And the books are open. God is reigning over history. Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, "You're going to become a beast until you know that the Most High God rules over the kingdoms of men." Chapter 4, verse 35. Nebuchadnezzar proclaims after his conversion that God is someone who is the true God, the Most High God. He is God of gods. And He does according to His will amongst all the host of heaven and the inhabitants of earth. And no one can stay His hand. That's what Nebuchadnezzar found out. Daniel in chapter 2, verse 21, in speaking of God, says that He removes kings and sets up kings. Job chapter 12, verse 23, He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. The Apostle Paul in Acts 17, verse 26, He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling places. God is ruling these kingdoms. He is ruling over this world. He is above it all. Now, verses 2 through 8. Note that the sea, which represents the world apart from God. Verse 2. There's this sea. The troubled sea. The stirring sea. And it's troubled and stirring because the four winds of heaven in verse 2 are stirring up this great sea. Look. The sea is symbolic for lost humanity, for the world without God. That's why in Revelation 21:1 we find out in the new heavens and the new earth, there is no sea. So this lost humanity is stirred up. How are they stirred up? By the winds of heaven. God is doing that. It's God's winds that are stirring it up. These beasts are coming about because God is working. And recognize, I'm sorry, I didn't recognize this before, but you got me back into it, and now I'm finding things. We're going to be in it for 7 more weeks. You ready? I'm just kidding, we're not. Recognize the first 3 beasts in verse 4, 5, and 6. All the verbs there are passive. These snarling beasts that think they're so tough, everything that's happening is happening to them. The first beast is the lion with wings. He is lifted up. He is made to stand. A mind of man is given him. The bear is raised up on one side, and he's told to devour all flesh. The leopard with the heads and the wings. Dominion is given to him. These are things happening to these beasts. God is working. God is doing it. The fourth beast is killed and destroyed. And the rest of the beasts, what? Have dominion taken. It's given, it's taken. Their lives are prolonged. God extends their lives a little bit. That's up to him. He's at work, he's sovereign. That's the picture. We see a God in control, giving and taking away, bringing them about, bringing them to an end. God sitting in judgment over them. We must emphasize this. Nation, I'm not saying the nations aren't responsible, because God sits in judgment, right? He's holding them accountable. God holds nations accountable. Here it is, right here. They are judged by His standard, by His perfect, holy, righteous standard. Before we move to the next point, do you recognize what this means? Look, the idea that you are not to judge the nations, the governments of this world, the kingdoms of this world. You're not to judge the world itself by the standard of God. Because they haven't entered into covenant with God. They never proclaimed themselves to be a Christian nation. So we can't judge them by that standard. We need to hold them to a different standard. Bull. That's not what it says. God holds them to His standard. He sits in judgment over kingdoms in relationship to Him. That this is exactly what we are supposed to proclaim. You're going to present the gospel to someone. You're going to make an argument about what the government shouldn't do or what law shouldn't be passed on the basis, not because you think laws are going to change things, but on the basis of Holy Scripture and absolute truth. And they're going to say to you, I don't believe the Bible. So are you going to put your sword up? No way. This is the standard. This is the standard we should hold all nations to. God does. And this comes into play in just a minute. Because the Son of Man is going to ascend to the right hand of the Father in glory. And then he's going to come and appear before His disciples before this ascension that we're about to see happens. And He's going to say, all authority on heaven has been... No. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Your Lord is Lord of all. Every nook and cranny of this place, this earth, is His. We should think about that. Whatever that might mean. And these thousands and thousands who are worshiping, these ten thousands and thousands and ten thousands of worshipers that are surrounding the throne, where do they come from? Where are these worshipers coming from? Are they coming from nowhere? No, where are they coming from? Nations! These beastly nations that include the United States of America. That's where they're coming from. You see Nebuchadnezzar, the lion with the wings. Who's in that nation? Daniel is in that nation. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in that nation. They don't belong to that kingdom. That's where they are. That's where believers come from. That's where worshipers come from. We proclaim a message that Jesus is Lord of all when we proclaim the gospel. That's all I'm saying. And recognize that what is the difference between everybody else, between everybody in that kingdom and those in the kingdom of God? Worship is the difference. worship. So, let's take a look at these beastly kingdoms. I think that everybody pretty much agrees that starting in verse 3, that there's successive kingdoms, beginning with Babylon first, in verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. If you look on the ancient gates of Babylon and the blue, beautiful blue stoned gates and walls that surround Babylon, you're going to see pictures of lions with wings. I think there's no doubt that Daniel passed by walls and murals during his time in Babylon. All over the place there were probably lions with wings. He probably recognizes this immediately. This is symbolic, though, I think, mostly of Nebuchadnezzar. He's lion. He's the most powerful on earth. Eagle's wings. He's sovereign over in the air, I think. I think that's his understanding of himself. And Daniel himself, when he first talks to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 about revealing his dream, tells him, you're the most powerful man on earth because God has made you that. But then his wings get plucked. And he becomes a beast, a land dweller alone until God gives him a mind of a man and converts him. That's the picture of Babylon, the picture of Nebuchadnezzar. So I think you can start with Nebuchadnezzar. I think you can start with Babylon. No doubt. This is Daniel's experience. We're moving from what Daniel knows and has experienced to what he doesn't. I think the next kingdom is probably the Medo-Persian kingdom. The bears raised up on one side because Persia is far greater than the Medes. I think that's probably a picture of the Medo-Persian kingdom. I think the next one being Greece, probably good. I think that's probably true. And then the fourth beast being Rome, I think that's absolutely the case, probably. Commentators for a long time have recognized those four kingdoms in history. I think that's probably exactly what he's being presented here. However, I also think that in the midst of these successive kingdoms and God's presenting himself as sovereign over all the world's kingdoms and all of the unfolding of history at the same time. The number 4 is symbolic of completeness or totality. So the idea that 4 kingdoms can, I think, probably, most likely, symbolically supposed to represent the totality of all of time. That these kingdoms are a picture of the world's kingdoms from now until Christ's return, taking various forms and functions of these kingdoms. I say this because we want to recognize the fourth kingdom. One of the reasons I say this, we want to recognize the fourth kingdom as Rome. Okay, great. And the 10 horns, the 10 emperors or Caesars, there's some issues with that, I think. Okay, that's fine. But see, this is a scope from now until Christ return. And there is no Roman Empire right now. So what this would, that therefore would mean that when the Roman Empire is done, then this persecution over God's people would be done. And it's not. It continues on forever between the advents until his return. So I don't think that works. I think this is to be symbolic of the totality of all of history. Does everybody understand that? I think that's what we're looking at here. When you get into the fourth kingdom, especially, that's when it's further explained in verse 23 through 26, there shall be a fourth kingdom different from all the others. That 10 horns, 10 kings shall arise, shall be different from the former ones. They will speak words against the Most High, wear out the saints of the Most High, change the times of the law that will be given to his hand for a time, time and a half, and half a time. It's in the fourth kingdom in which the stone in chapter 2, which is Christ and his kingdom, crashes into the statue. Christ came and was triumphant during the time of the Roman Empire, absolutely. That's when victory was won. But because this persecution and difficulty for believers goes on, I think that you have to understand this more symbolically. God is used giving pictures of kingdoms, some of them Daniel knows and will be familiar with, more in recent history for him perhaps, but it's symbolic of all of history. Let me show you why, another reason why I think that. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 12 right quick. Now obviously we can't get as deep in these things as we maybe could. In Revelation chapter 12 through 15, we get an understanding as to why there's such a great persecution against the church. In chapter 12, you see this dragon standing before this woman that is symbolic of the people of God or the messianic humanity that is going to be the people of God. And they bring forth a child who is Christ. Obviously, it's Christ. She gave birth to a male child who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Now listen, immediately there's this dragon before a woman giving birth, and immediately this child is caught up into heaven by God. He goes straight from birth to ascension. It's just a symbolic way of presenting victory, and he's put on the throne. This is what's going on earth. And at the same time, from verse 7 to verse 9, you see this picture of what's going on in heaven. A war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting the dragon. The dragon is Satan, and his angels fighting back. But he was defeated. There was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who was called the devil, the deceiver of the whole world, thrown down to earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a voice saying, verse 10, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come." Listen. "For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of the testimony. For they love not their lives even unto death." So what are we seeing here? What we're seeing here is Christ born, Christ's triumphant victory in his ascension, Satan defeated, Satan thrown out of heaven. Now, how is Satan thrown out of heaven? Listen, before Christ's triumph, you see this throughout the Bible, think of Job. Satan has some kind of way to the throne of God, and what does he do there? He accuses the saints. But now, because Christ's triumph, there is no more accusation. He can't make an accusation anymore. He's thrown out, and his sphere is restricted, and his defeat is sure, and he's mad. Christ is ascended, so who is he after? Me and you. That's who he's after. That's the picture of chapter 12. Now, chapter 13, Satan's angry. The picture is Satan standing on the shore. Standing on the beach, not on vacation, calling the beast out of the sea. That's what he's doing. Look at verse 1. "And I saw," so the last verse in chapter 12, "and he stood on the sand of the sea." Verse 1, chapter 13. "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea." What do you see? 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 diadems on its horns, and blasphemous names on its head. And then listen to these. "And the beast that I saw, like a leopard, and a bear, and a lion." See those pictures? Now look, now all these individual successive kingdoms of Daniel chapter 7 are one beast coming out of the sea. "And to it, the dragon." Who is behind this beast? Satan himself is behind this beast, calling it out of the sea. "One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed." 3 times you're going to find in chapter 13, seemed to be dead. It's a mortal wound. It's a wound that kills. but it's healed. That makes no sense. The idea is it keeps coming back. You think it's dead, and it comes back again. And you think it's dead, and it comes back again. And then once again, you see the sovereignty of God over this beast. Satan thinks he's in charge. But then verse 5, and the beast was given a mouth for haughty, blasphemous words, and allowed to exercise authority. Verse 7, it's allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given to it over tribes and tongues and nations. Then you have a second beast, which comes out of the earth. And then you're going to see the same thing. Verse 14, it's allowed to work in the presence of the beast as it deceives those who dwell on earth. Verse 15, and it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast. The difference between the first and the second beast. The first beast persecutes, devours, trying to destroy the kingdom of God through persecution. The second beast is trying to destroy the people of the kingdom of God through deception. It's deceiving. It looks, it's a lamb with two horns. It looks kind of like Jesus, maybe. Looks good. But then when it talks, it speaks the words of the dragon. How is Satan after you and me? Through persecution and suffering, through deception and lies. That's how he's after you and I. These are symbolic of all the beasts for all time. They're going to come in various forms and fashions, taking on these same attributes and aspects that the first four in Daniel chapter 7 had. Here they are again, all the same, all part of one together. In chapter 17, we hear about the beast more. And what you find in chapter 17, several times. Verse 11, as for the beast, listen. As for the beast that was and is not, and is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. It was and is not and is. Look at verse 8. The beast you saw was and is not and is about to rise. Again, at the end of verse 8. It was and is not and is to come. Verse 11. As for the beast, it was and is not and is to come. It was and it's not and it's just to come. See, it's coming, keeps on coming. It was at one time. It may not be now, but it's going to come again. It looks like a mortal wound, but it's not killed forever. It's allowed to live. It comes back. This is life. Okay, now, turn back to Daniel 7 after all that. What are we supposed to understand? That means the picture in Daniel 7 is you and I living between the triumph of Christ and the consummation of His return. According to Revelation 12 and 13, God's people are persecuted. Not because Satan is strong, but because he's beaten. He's defeated. That's the reason for the persecution that we experience. He's behind all the beasts of the world from now until he returns, till Christ returns, working. Take as many as he can. Persecuting and deceiving. He's after us. Victory is sure. Triumph is accomplished. The battle rages. And this is the time in which you and I live. Now, I wanted you to see this big picture. And this is the focus of Daniel chapter 7. This is what we're supposed to see. Perhaps above all else. Christ comes, he preaches the kingdom. He says, the kingdom of God is here. And then he says, suffering. And everybody's like, what? Right? It's because it's the nearness of the kingdom the glorious nearness of the kingdom. Christ is here, and the not yet of the kingdom. It has not yet been consummated. The nearness and the not yet. It's why Christ can invite people to come. And one man can say to him, I'll go with you anywhere. And Christ says, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. I'll go with you anywhere. He doesn't say, you bet you will. Great. He says, don't you know there's going to be suffering? Then the next guy comes along. And Jesus says, follow me. And he says, let me go bury my father first. And Jesus says, let the dead bury their dead. So, see, to one man, he says, who's enthusiastic about following him, he says, don't you know how humble and suffer, how much suffering is going to be there? And then to one man who refuses to follow because he's got other things to do, he says, don't you know how great I am? Don't you know how humble I am? Don't you know how great I am? He can say those things, and it's not schizophrenia. It's true. Because the glorious nearness of the kingdom, it's here. It's come in power and glory. Don't you see the greatness of it? Don't you want it? Who wouldn't want Jesus? Who wouldn't want to follow Jesus? Don't you see the suffering and the difficulty? Who would want to do that? Right? That's what you see. That's what's going on in the gospel so often. It's what's going on in our lives. This is what Daniel's trying to figure out. The glory of the Ancient of Days. He's in charge. And God's people are persecuted. Revelation 13:8 says that those whose names are in the book, the Lamb's Book of Life, are at war with the beast. If your name is in the book, you're at war with the beast. He causes suffering, difficulty. This helps us to understand, okay? The beasts of this world at any given time have been Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, or Alexander the Great, Nero, Domitian, Bloody Mary, the Spanish Inquisition, Hitler, Stalin, the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Cambodian killing fields, Rwanda. The beasts keep coming. The health director of your country. Whenever you live, wherever you live, evil powers, rulers, and forces will be lined up against you. And if apart from God, the beast will be working in them to bring about your suffering and persecution, to bring about your deception, to allure you with the world's things. Like Belshazzar, the enemy is knocking at the gates. And he's bringing out the finest china and getting drunk. People in this world, the day of judgment is coming for them. Their life is going to be called to account any second now. And yours might be also. And they're eating and drinking, making money, investing in the material goods of this earth. Because the devil says, doesn't this look good? This will make you happy. This will give you fulfillment. This will satisfy you. Or he's crushing you with persecution, thinking you'll give up, but you won't. That's how he works. That's what we're supposed to see. Above all else, I think, that's what we're supposed to see. Neither look to the world for satisfaction, nor be discouraged by whatever's happening at any time in this world, because your God is in charge. and God is in control. Now, that's a long first point. Secondly, real fast. We see, first of all, that God does indeed reign over history, but also that the Son of Man rises in victory. Jesus, on the morning of his death, standing before the rulers of Israel, I mean the judges of Israel, all the religious rulers and judges of Israel, all gathered in one place. And High Priest Caiaphas says, "Tell us that you are the Messiah. Tell us if you are the Messiah." Mark 14. This is Mark 14, Matthew 26. Here you have in Daniel 7 a picture of the Son of Man coming on clouds to the Father. Centuries later, Jesus, standing before these religious rulers, asked to admit that he's the Messiah, says, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man coming on clouds to the Father." And Caiaphas rips his clothes, makes a big ordeal out of it, cusses as a Jewish religious leader would cuss, whatever that would say, whatever he would say. Absolutely can't believe what Jesus has just said because he understands what Jesus is talking about. Jesus has taken this Son of Man language from Daniel chapter 7 and given it to himself. And that's what got him killed. It didn't get him killed necessarily that he said he was the Son of God. It was the Son of Man that was the final nail, as it were. They regarded Jesus as a beast. It turns out it wasn't Jesus, it was the high priest that was the beast. The chief priest was a chief beast. And now Jesus is enthroned. He's the enthroned Son of Man. If you're going to be on the side of God, you have to be on the side of Jesus. Because Jesus is King. The Son of Man, this language, it's interesting. In that it connects the kingdom with Jesus himself. Son of God isn't necessarily speaking of divinity as much as it is obedience. Remember, Jesus says to the religious rulers at one spot when they say, Abraham is our father. And Jesus says, if Abraham were your father, you would do like he does. It had to do with following after, obedience to. The Son of Man, we think it means, it's talking about humanity, the humanity of Jesus. It's not really talking about the humanity of Jesus. It's really talking more about the divinity of Jesus. Because he got it from Daniel chapter 7. In which he's coming on clouds, which is something that only God would do. It was a way of concealing who he was and also revealing who he was at the same time. 52 separate times in the Gospels, Jesus uses the Son of Man. And Jesus is the only one who calls him the Son of Man. It's his favorite title for himself. The Son of Man is his favorite title. And preaching the kingdom is his favorite sermon. It's the kingdom and the Son of Man. And they're connected. They're connected in Jesus. And we're talking about the Son of Man. Listen to some of these scriptures. It's talking about authority. It's talking about his authority. You don't realize all the times he uses it. Listen, in Mark chapter 2, after he forgives a man's sins and then heals his legs. He says, is it easier to heal a man or to forgive him of his sins, but so that you know that I am the Son of Man, stand up and walk. He says the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He says the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. He says in Luke 19, the Son of Man came to seek and to save. John chapter 5, it's the Son of Man who executes judgment and authority because He is the Son of Man. In John chapter 1, hearkening back to Genesis and Jacob's dream of a ladder going into heaven, Jesus says, you will see the Son of Man, angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. It's authority. It's His divine authority. It's the authority that only comes from God. It's the authority that proves He is God. This is what they preached in the early church. They preached the kingdom. John the Baptist comes preaching the kingdom. Jesus comes preaching the kingdom. Matthew chapter 4. Jesus is in the wilderness, being tempted by Satan. And Satan says, I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world if you bow. That's exactly why Jesus came. To get all the kingdoms. But not like that. For the very first time, Satan left a man defeated. Every other time before that, Satan won those battles. And this is Satan's first death blow. And then immediately we go to Matthew chapter 5 and Jesus preaches the sermon about the kingdom. The Sermon on the Mount. And then He goes, does what a king does in presenting His kingdom. He starts to heal. He starts to throw into reverse all that Adam messed up. This is the glory of the Son of Man coming to the Father. He's raised. He's ascended. He's crowned. He's declared Lord of all. That's why we should preach it. That's why I emphasized earlier not to take your faith and the Lord of all and compartmentalize Him in church on Sunday and refuse to bring Him out into the world the rest of the week or into the voting booth or anywhere else you might go. He's Lord. All kingdoms have been given to Him. Psalm 2. Sit at My right hand, I will give you all the nations. Psalm 110, sit at My right hand till I make all your enemies your footstool. These glorious pictures of ascension. This is what we see here. This is the picture. I wanted you to see the connection between the Son of Man and the kingdom. I wanted you to understand what that's all about. Finally, we're out of time. There's more to say. I just wanted to hit on this anyway, finally. He comes with authority, right? He rules with authority. Listen, if this is true, I'm going to let you go. Just give me a couple more minutes. He rules with authority. He's been given all the kingdoms of this earth. All authority has been given to Me, He says, in heaven and on earth. Psalm 110, the Lord said to My Lord, sit at My right hand till I make all your enemies your footstool. That's what's happening right now. Right now, the Father is in the process of making all of Christ's enemies His footstool, bringing all things in subjection to Him, in submission to Him. That's what God's doing. Shouldn't we be lined up with that? That's my point. I've never thought about it this way before, but please give it some thought. If the Father right now is making all the enemies of Christ His footstool, then that means that we should be about the same business. What are the enemies of Christ? And how can I put them in subjection to Him? That's what we should be about the business of doing, right? That's what the Father's doing. Isn't that what He's doing through us? You will rule in the midst of your enemies. I will make all your enemies your footstool. The last enemy being death. At that point, 1 Corinthians 15, Christ takes the kingdoms and He gives them all to the Father. It's a picture of what Adam was to do. He's to take dominion over the garden and make the whole world the garden and give it all to the Father. That was supposed to be the first thing that happened. What was supposed to be the first thing now has become the last thing. Christ has won all the kingdoms of the world. He's taken this wilderness and made all things new. Now He's going to give it to the Father. And you and I are a part of that. That's the glory of this. You and I are a part of that. We will rule and reign with Him. What is your life about? What is your purpose? What are you giving yourself to? Is it anything even in the same universe that is as glorious as this? The overarching purpose of God in having the church on earth after Christ has ascended is what? It's to first of all make sure that we're not an enemy of Christ. Make sure that we're looking at the world like Christ does and recognizing what is His enemy and what's not. Because I think we rage against things that may not be the enemy of Christ, while the things that are the enemies of Christ we are excusing. But isn't our life supposed to be about this purpose? How can I invest my life and bring about a faith in my children and in the people that surrounded me in such a way as to bring about this purpose? And working in line with the Father and bringing all the enemies of Christ in subjection to Him, in submission to Him. He's Lord of all. Listen, He's Lord of all.